Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live, and a very happy approaching end of Advent. Very happy Advent continues, so I can still wish you happy Advent. Thanks for being with us. We very much appreciate you taking this time to be with us.
Let them hold you down, Si.
Don't let who hold me down?
Anyone who wants to stop you from wishing people happy Advent.
It's a conspiracy. Yeah. It's a conspiracy. Although,
fight the power.
I'm fighting those anti- Advent powers. Yes. Yeah. Jimmy Akin here, as you can hear. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers. Second hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be with us. And it's open forum. You can ask anything you want. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. We are heading towards a rainy Christmas here in Southern California. I don't remember last time we had a rainy Christmas.
It's all H2O to me.
Yeah, I guess it is. Rain, snow, it's all H2O. That turned out to be a poem, and I didn't even mean that. 888-318-7884. Ask whatever you like, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not. Your call is welcome here, 888-318-7884. Jimmy is, as you know, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and this week on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Friday will be Christmas Eve.
Yes.
So the Christmas Eve show is... It's not weird questions because that's New Year's Eve show.
No, it's Christmas weird questions. So these will be
Christmas weird
questions.
Well,
actually, it's going to be Christmas questions.
And great.
I believe they're all weird this time, but they are all Christmas themed.
Oh, very, very good.
And then I have something else going on Saturday for Christmas Day.
What's that?
Well, so there are various people who can't get together with others on Christmas.
Right.
And this year, even more than normal because of, you know, everything that's going on.
Yes.
And so I decided to do something for people who don't have anyone to be with on Christmas. I'm going to do a live stream on YouTube for an hour or two. And it's meant to help out people who don't have anyone to be with, but I'm going to answer questions.
How fun.
And anybody is welcome to come and participate, whether you have people to be with or not. It's meant for everybody. So if you go to youtube.com/JimmyAkin, there's already a reminder there, and you can click the set up a reminder, and it'll notify you on Christmas Day when the live stream is going to start. And it's going to be at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific.
Okay.
And it'll go for an hour or two, depending on the questions that people have. So if you have questions, weird or not, you know, get them ready. And it's also for Mysterious World listeners. So if you have mysterious questions, that's fine. But I thought it would be nice to do something on Christmas Day for people.
What a nice thing, Jimmy. YouTube.com/JimmyAkin. That is really, really cool. I know that in my own family, we always have a big get-together, and then last year didn't do it, and this year we're all set to do it, and now I think the enthusiasm is waning because of, like you said, all that's going on this year.
Yeah.
Variance. I never thought the word variance would be such a bane.
Uh-huh.
But it is. 888-318-7884. That's very nice, Jimmy. That's cool. They're going to be doing that on Christmas Day. Very, very nice. And then, like, if they're outside of the United States, I assume they can join
on their own time, even if it's even if it's not Christmas Day anymore.
Oh yeah, they're right, because in some places it will be already Boxing Day. 888-318-7884. The number, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Let's start with Anonymous. Always good to start with a good Anonymous call. Hang on, Anonymous, I'm getting to you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. No, hang on, Anonymous. I'm getting to you wrong, probably. I'm probably starting off wrong. Anonymous, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, there we go. We got you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, wonderful. It's good to talk to you, Si and Jimmy. I got a question. It's a really difficult topic for me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to give just a little bit, like a minute of explanation so you get the context, and I'll just jump right into that.
Actually, why don't you give me the question first, and then I'll back up and ask if I need context.
Well, that's a little hard of why I feel this way, but basically my question concerns, shouldn't there be a possibility in light of tradition in the Old Testament, basically in a fulfilled situation, shouldn't there be like at least a limited possibility for lay people in their own domestic churches to offer the Eucharist? And I could tell you why I've been really struggling with this.
Okay. Tell me why you're struggling with it.
Okay, because I fear that unvaccinated Catholics here may soon no longer be permitted to receive the Eucharist by my bishop. Mm-hmm. I, as a father, am considering offering the Eucharist myself. I believe mm-hmm. that I have such authority from the sacrament of matrimony as a kind of ordination and have authority only over my family. So I believe that I can't offer the Eucharist publicly in the parish, on the parish altar or on the cathedral altar. And I still do want to attend Sunday Masses as long as it's possible to maintain communion. Mm-hmm. I believe that the laying on of hands is necessary to give grace, needed to be a priest over many families, but is not necessarily needed for me to be a priest over my own, just as Abraham didn't have hands laid upon him to offer sacrifice.
Okay.
So in my mind, if it's possible, in my mind, this is just the true fulfillment and reversal of the golden calf. And I also believe in this idea of like from like. If I'm a member of the body, I can offer the body of mm-hmm. Christ. And at the anamnesis of the Eucharist, which I enter into too, it said, you know, it's like Christ saying to me, do this in remembrance of me. And I just wonder if the church has never really looked at this angle and just basically always just looked at it from a public angle.
Okay.
Oh, Jimmy? It sounds like you got cut off there. This is an area that the church has looked at and it has considered this. And there have been questions raised about this, and the church has concluded. Now, I'm very hesitant to say something is infallible unless it's really, really clear mm-hmm. that that's the case. I take very seriously the instruction in the Code of Canon Law in Canon 749, Section 3, to not hold that a particular proposition has been infallibly defined unless this is manifestly evident. So not just evident,
right,
but manifestly evident. And as a result, you will hear lots of people on Catholic radio who toss around the term infallible much more freely than I do,
okay,
because they don't take that. I don't attribute it to any fault of theirs, but they haven't studied the matter closely, the issue of infallibility closely, and I have. I've written a whole book dealing with that subject, and I would say that the church has infallibly settled this question that you need sacramental ordination in order to be able to celebrate the Eucharist in a priestly capacity. This is something. Now, you mentioned some things in the Bible, like Abraham did not need hands laid on him in order to offer sacrifice, and that's true. He didn't. In the patriarchal age, the economy of sacrifice was handled differently than it came to be. And so in the patriarchal age, what you needed to be in order to offer sacrifice to Yahweh was be a patriarch. So if you were the head of a family, if you were a father that was the head of a family, you could offer sacrifice in the patriarchal age. That's quite true. But then there was a shift, and the shift occurred during the time of the Exodus, and specifically with the golden calf incident, and you had and related stuff, where you had the Israelites participating in illicit pagan worship, and the Levites, the tribe of Levi, rallied to Moses in defense of monotheistic worship of Yahweh, and as a result of that, Moses said, "Today you've consecrated yourself priests." And so as a result, the priesthood was shifted from something anybody could do to something you had to be a member of the tribe of Levi to do. And specifically, you had to be a member of the line of Aaron. But what we find when we get to the New Testament is not a reversion back to the patriarchal model. Instead, from the first century onward, we see an ordained priesthood where you did have a laying on of hands that was not simply what happened in the patriarchal age. As you point out, Abraham didn't need hands laid on him in order to be a priest. He had that function automatically as a result of being a patriarch. But we see in the New Testament, the sacramental priesthood is passed on by the laying on of hands. And from the earliest centuries, from the beginning of the second century, we see a prohibition, and this is in the Letters of Ignatius of Antioch, a prohibition on participating in a Eucharist celebrated by anybody unless it's the bishop or someone who the bishop has appointed, meaning ordained.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been the universal tradition in the Catholic Church all the way down through the centuries, and it is something that the Church has reflected on. And although I would need to, you know, do some compiling to show you that, to show you this, I would say this is something that has been infallibly settled, that you do need sacramental ordination in order to be a priest capable of celebrating the Eucharist. It is not something ordinary lay people can do, not for their own families or in other contexts.
And we'll leave it there because we got to go to our break. But thank you very much. I'm glad that you called on that. We're willing to discuss that with Jimmy Akin, and appreciate it very, very much. Anonymous, hope we'll talk again. I'm going to take a break. We'll come back with more Open Forum for Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Next hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here. It's open forum both hours, 888-31-TRUTH, the number. Going to Tennessee now. Jonathan, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jonathan, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Merry Christmas, Si. Merry Christmas, Jimmy.
And to you. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my question is concerning apostolic succession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is my understanding during the early centuries that there may have been records lost due to time or persecution, things like that. So how can we, you know, what are some methods that we can use to be reasonably sure or certain of apostolic succession with that gap in certain areas?
Okay, so the in terms of the basic concept of apostolic succession, it's that the authority to govern the church and so forth was passed down from the apostles to later generations of Christians. And the specific form through which that happened was through the bishops. Now, we can infer that apostolic succession happened, and there are other aspects of apostolic succession we can document in other ways, but we can infer the basic fact of apostolic succession by the fact from the facts that Jesus deemed his church needed a guiding apostolic authority, which he gave it by instituting the apostles. But then we can infer that, and we can further infer that this this form of structure, this hierarchical structure with leaders and so forth, is fundamental to the constitution of the church because, number one, every organization that's going to succeed and survive long term needs organization in one form or another. It's not just me and Jesus. Jesus didn't set up that kind of institution. And if you want the Christian community to hang together, it's going to need to have organization. It therefore needs a structure. It needs leaders and things like that. And furthermore, Jesus gave it this in its very first generation upon its institution. And so the idea of an apostolic authority is something fundamental to the church that Jesus wished it to have. However, he did not wish the College of Apostles to continue beyond the first century, which is why we don't have apostles today. And from that, we can infer that the authority to guide and govern the church was something that was passed down from the apostles to another generation of leaders, and that it's been continued to be passed down to today, because in Matthew 16, Jesus says the gates of hell will not prevail against his church. Gates of hell, or gates of Hades in Greek, Hades was the place of the dead, and so Jesus is saying his church will never die. So his church still exists today. It still has the kind of constitution and all of the elements that he gave it at its institution. And so it has this apostolic governing authority, meaning a governing authority that comes from the apostles. We then have the question of, well, through what mechanism was this passed down? And that's not something that the New Testament addresses directly, but we do find it directly addressed in early Christian writings outside of the New Testament in the second century. And they specifically say that when the apostles passed from the scene, they passed on their authority to the office of the bishops. And so the Episcopal College, or the College of Bishops, has now inherited the role that the College of the Apostles originally played as the supreme governing authority within the earthly church. And we see this in second century writings, such as Irenaeus of Lyon and others, who pointed out that when the apostles passed, they gave this authority to the College of Bishops. Now, you can then have a question of, well, how do I know an individual bishop is validly ordained in a line going back to the apostles? And the in a given bishop's case, you could always question, it would be very rare, but you could always question, well, maybe something went wrong with his ordination and this guy's ordination was invalid. But you're not going to have that broad-based, because the church has historically built multiple redundancies into the ordination process for bishops. So typically, when you have an episcopal consecration, it's not just one bishop laying hands on the new bishop. It's three bishops, and in some cases even more, laying hands on the newly created bishop. And as a result of that, even if there was a problem with the ordination of one of those three bishops that are laying hands on the new bishop, the ordination would be supplied by the other two. And so there are multiple redundancies built into the system so that any invalid order that a particular person may have received is not passed on beyond one generation.
That all makes sense to you, Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I guess the main reason I bring this up is, just real quick, a friend of mine is very seriously considering becoming Catholic, and I went over apostolic succession with him, and that was that last part of your question is really kind of tuned in, is, well, how do we know that specific bishop can go be traced all the way back to the apostles? So I think that was very helpful.
Great. Good, Jonathan.
In some eras in the church, they would even consecrate bishops more than once in their career, just to make sure as even extra redundancy. So, like, even if there was a problem, it'll be extinguished now.
Jonathan, thank you very much, and I'm very glad that you found that helpful. I'm going to go all the way out. It's lunchtime right now out there in Honolulu, Hawaii. JT, thanks for calling us at lunchtime.
Thank you, and aloha.
Aloha, JT.
So the question I had was wondering, is it contradictory for God to be perfectly merciful and perfectly just? The reason I was kind of thinking about this question was I was thinking about the idea of hell a lot, and I thought, well, we would say that that is a just thing, but no one would say hell is an inherently merciful or good thing. The scriptures makes it very clear that hell is not a very ideal place to be. It's not Honolulu. So my thought was, even if it's just, it wouldn't be merciful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, let's say there was full-scale universalism. Well, that'd be very merciful. Everyone's really happy, but everyone gets the same thing in the end, so their actions don't matter, and so that wouldn't be just.
All right.
You wouldn't give either their due.
So it's possible to analyze the concepts of justice and mercy in more than one way and on more than one level. And you can generate a contradiction between them by understanding them in ways that the church does not, and in essence create a straw man. So you kind of have a straw man justice and a straw man mercy, and you pit them against each other and kind of bash them together, and the straw goes flying and you've got a contradiction. What the church understands God's justice to mean is that, and what Catholic theology has historically, is that God will provide the appropriate consequences for a person's actions, moral and immoral, in an appropriate way. That does not mean he's going to punish everybody mercilessly for everything they did, because that would leave no room for mercy. Similarly, the church and Catholic theology historically has not understood justice to mean that God will just forgive anything you do and there will never be negative consequences as a result. That would be more towards the universalist end, and that is also not the church's understanding. So if you take these concepts and push them to extremes, which the church does not hold, well, then you can generate straw men with a contradiction. What the church understands is that God's justice and mercy work harmoniously together, and this is like a situation that we find in human life, where you have parent, let's take a parenting example. I could put it in a courtroom, I could put it in any number of settings, but let's take a parenting example. Cy Kellett, you're a father.
Yes.
And you've had children.
Yes.
As a result of being a father. And
wait, I don't know, one result? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and and sometimes those children have done things that they should not.
Right.
And they need to learn a lesson not to do it.
Right.
So you've had to punish your children in one way or another.
Right.
Now, suppose that your children has done one of these things and you've made the determination that the child needs to learn a lesson, and the child is like, I don't care. I'm totally unrepentant.
Yeah.
I would do this again. You're just being a mean old man.
I know which of my children this is too.
Okay. So we'll let that pass.
Yeah.
But in that circumstance, would it be appropriate to say, you know, even though you haven't learned your lesson, and you need to for your own good, I'm not going to punish you after all? Or would it be appropriate to say, okay, you've got this defiant attitude, you've done this thing you shouldn't, you do need to learn your lesson, it's for your own good, therefore I'm going to punish you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, but suppose you have the same kind of situation where a child's done the exact same thing, they need to learn their lesson, but before you punish them, they really take it to heart. And they think about it and they say, you know, Dad, I've thought about it. I realized that had consequences that were bad, and I'm very sorry, and I'm not going to do that again. And they're sincere, and you know they're sincere.
Yeah.
And so in effect, they've already learned their lesson, and they no longer need to learn their lesson for their own good or for the good example of the other kids. Well, in that case, is it appropriate to punish them mercilessly or to give them mercy?
Mercy, definitely.
Yeah. And so this is how the church understands the way God is both just and merciful. He applies justice and mercy, and the gradation between just and merciful actions, strict justice and strict mercy. There's a spectrum in there where you can combine elements of justice and mercy. But he applies justice and mercy in the perfectly appropriate way, given the circumstances. And so if someone does wrong and they are completely unrepentant, whether it's mortal or not, God will give them the appropriate consequences from that. And if they are repentant, well, then there's grounds for mercy, and God will show them mercy to the degree that these grounds warrant. And then God has now God's dealing with a whole universe here and a community, so it's a little bit bigger than just an individual family. But God will ultimately apply justice and mercy in the way that are appropriate in a given situation. And there are additional factors that need to be taken into account beyond the ones I've mentioned, but that's the general principle. God will apply these two things in a perfect way given the situation that is at hand. And so ultimately, these are two aspects, really, you could say, of a single virtue. In fact, justice is sometimes defined in terms of giving someone what is their due.
Yes.
Well, that can be understood in more than one way, and understood in a somewhat broader way than might first strike somebody, if mercy is what someone is due based on the fact their repentance, then God will give them mercy. And that is subsumed within this broader conception of what justice is.
JT, we're just coming right up on the break, so I'll just say thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. And glad to hear that you believe Honolulu is better than hell. I think that's
Most people would agree with that. Not necessarily everybody, but most.
No, I don't think it's a lot. But I like Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but, you know, perfect tropical city.
If I was going to show hometown tribalism, I would say, well, Honolulu is no San Diego.
That is true. And then the people in Honolulu could say, wait, I don't know.
San Diego is no Honolulu.
Right, exactly. JT, thanks very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. One line open right now. Lots more calls to come. 888-318-7884.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Do you have a Christmas wish for the world?
Let us know what it is tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
On most of these EWTN stations.
Now we return to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. I just got to read one ad, and then we're going back to the phones. And I haven't read it yet, but I'm betting that the
Lay
words,
it honest, man.
What are you waiting for, are going to appear somewhere in this ad.
Carrie loves to put,
what are you waiting for in the ad?
What am I waiting for? Read me the ad.
All right, here it comes. A faith you can defend is a faith you can own and embrace. Enroll your loved one or yourself right now in one of our School of Apologetics courses, now at our lowest prices of the year, today and tomorrow. Over 50% off, $40 for full courses and just $20 for mini courses, including Trent's Arguing Against Abortion mini course. What are you waiting for?
There you go.
Head on over to shop.catholic.com.
Carrie, you were precognitive on that. You should keep a spreadsheet.
Of how often
you're precognitive.
It's not precognitive, though, if the person always does it and then you're just like, he's probably going to do that again.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you always want to look for naturalistic explanations of paranormal phenomena first. Right. So that's good.
What are you waiting for? I can't wait till the day Carrie comes in and says, I heard you talking about my wedding. What are you waiting for on the air? But
he could mix it up, throw you a curveball.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're waiting. No, I don't know. Well, Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the EWTN app. Glad to have you, Emma. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I figured I should have done this anonymous, but here we go. I don't tell this story very often. Mm-hmm. My kids did to me a mini exorcism. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that's what it is. I'm an alcoholic, And 11 years ago, they told my husband to bring the baby upstairs and they were going to pray for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke in a shrill voice, mm-hmm. and I pushed one of my sons across the room.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other details I don't like to remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, but I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 month later, I went into rehab the next day, which I was not going to rehab. And 1 month later, I was sober.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I just want to know what you think of that. Do you think it was, do they have the power to do that?
Okay. Let me ask a couple of follow-up questions. When this event occurred, were you sober at the time? I mean, were you under the influence of alcohol at that moment?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
I was. That's why I don't remember it.
Okay. Do you remember any aspects of it? Like you said, you spoke with a shrill voice. Do you remember doing that or pushing someone?
All I remember is saying, I'm going to bed. That's the only thing I remember.
Okay. And you're wondering about, do lay people have the power, like your family, to do exorcistic type prayers, and could they have freed you from a demon here? Is that the basic question?
Yeah.
Okay.
They talked to the demon directly.
Oh, okay.
And asked how long he had been with me. And he said in a vulgar language, I've been with her since her uncle messed with her. But he didn't say messed with her.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And so they spoke and an alternative to you, and an alternative personality manifested and spoke back.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I would say that it's given that, it increases the chances that there could have been demonic involvement here. Now, we mentioned my podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, earlier in this episode, and we've got Christmas and New Year's episodes coming up. But for the first Friday in January, we're going to have, it's episode 188, and it is specifically about when demons are involved and when they're not, and how to diagnose whether or not a demon is involved. And so I would recommend that you keep an ear out for that. You can check that out if you'd like more information than what I'm about to give you. But I would say that one of the criteria that lends additional support to the demon hypothesis, if we can call it that, in a particular case, is whether an alternative personality manifests and interacts. And it, based on what your family has told you, there was, in this experience, an alternative personality that manifested and interacted. However, as I mentioned to Cy in our discussion just before your call, it is important when considering a paranormal phenomenon to look for alternative explanations on the natural level. And in fact, that's something that the church actually talks about in its official rite of exorcism, which is a document that's given to priests to be able to diagnose and then perform exorcisms when demons are present. And it mentions that you can't just assume it's a demon. You have to also look for naturalistic hypotheses that could explain it. And so in this case, we do have the manifestation of an alternative personality, but can there be natural explanations for that? Well, if you had a history of mental illness, and there was something, there's a condition, it used to be called multiple personality disorder. These days it's known as dissociative identity disorder. But basically, and there are questions you can ask about, you know, dissociative identity disorder and what is the actual explanation for it and so forth. But basically, it is a natural psychological phenomenon that causes people to act as if they're someone else. And so you haven't mentioned having a history of mental illness or dissociative conditions. So I'm going to assume that's not the case. But also what you have said is that you were under the influence of alcohol. And if you were hostile towards your family members, like you mentioned, you shoved someone, and if they're doing something to you that you don't like, which obviously was the case in this situation if you shoved someone, and then they start talking to you as if you're a demon, in a state of intoxication, you might just go along with that. You might decide, you know, you're mad at them, you shoved somebody, and you want to mess with them. And so you pretend, yeah, I've got a demon. I'm going to mess with you. I'm going to scare you. I'm going to freak you out because I'm mad at you. And so you would be able to attest, if you had clear memories of this situation, you would be able to attest to whether that's what you were doing. You know, but you don't have clear memories, and so I would say that the situation is ambiguous. It could have a natural explanation. You know, if you're just drunk and you're fooling with them or whatever, it also could have a demonic explanation. So, I would say the evidence from that point of view is ambiguous. Then we have the fact that they performed some kind of exorcistic act on you. And you had a question about that. Can lay people do that? Lay people in the Catholic Church are never authorized to perform full exorcisms, but they are allowed to participate in what are known as minor exorcisms or deliverance prayers. And certainly if they have signs that someone may be under the influence of a demon, it doesn't have to be full-blown possession, but if it is full-blown possession, they should be calling in a priest. But if someone may be under some form of demonic influence or demonic assault, then laity are able to perform minor exorcisms or deliverance prayers, and those prayers are ones God can grant, you know? Yeah. That's all a major exorcism is anyway. It's a special kind of solemn prayer for God's deliverance in a particular situation. But it's ultimately up to God what happens. And so if there was some level of demonic involvement in this situation, well, then God may have granted their prayers and helped you get sober, and that would be great. On the other hand, let's suppose there was no demon in this situation, that you were just messing with them or something like that. Well, they still wanted you to get the help you needed from God. And so even if they were mistaken about it being a demon that was resulting in this, God knew their hearts. And he knew even better than that, he knew what you needed. And so if you were at a point in your life where you needed to be free of this and you needed to get to sobriety and they were praying for it and you were open on some deep level to that, even if you were consciously, you know, resistant to it, well, then God may have answered that prayer. And even if there was no demon there, God could still help you get sober. And so I would say that at least based on the facts that, you know, I could always do an extensive interview with you and seek more facts that might point in one direction or the other. But I would say based on the evidence that you've mentioned here on the air, there are some things that could point that could at least be suggestive of possible demonic involvement. But on the other hand, it's not at all certain that that was the case. There are alternative explanations that we haven't ruled out. And so I would say regardless of which of those is the case, thank God that he worked in your life, and whether there was a demon or not, or whether it was just the spirit of alcohol, so to speak, a purely natural spirit that you needed deliverance from, thank God that you were delivered from the situation. And I would leave the question of was there really a demon involved here, since there doesn't seem to be at this point an urgent need to settle that question, I'd say leave that in God's hands, and you'll find out one day in heaven. But just rejoice that God has delivered you from that situation and can continue to deliver you from any similar things, and just trust him and rejoice in his love and the love of your family.
Praise God. Emma, I have to go to the break, so I'm not going to come back to you, but I do want to offer you, I'd love to send you a Christmas present of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life. If you hang on, we'll send it to you. It won't get to you by Christmas, but it's too late for that now, but consider it a Christmas gift to you, and call back anytime. We'd love to talk with you again. I got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
I do listen, and I love EWTN. My mother loved EWTN. It's just a wonderful way, and I thank you for what you're doing, the courage that you have for telling us how it is with Jesus, God, Mary, all of it. We have to get back to something in this country, or we're doomed.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Open forum both hours. Next hour, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here. Also, just want to let you know, we'll have new shows for you every day right up until, forever, I guess. I mean, but we're going to continue right through the end of the year, and then we'll start up the next year as well. So join us, all new shows next week. Let's go to Daniel right here in California, in Mission Viejo, California, watching on YouTube. Daniel, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. My question is more of a broad question on judgment. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it after Mass on Sunday. Mm-hmm. When we recite the Nicene Creed, he will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. So my question is, if Jesus was crucified for our sin, for our salvation, then where does judgment come into play?
Well, so we mentioned in a previous question that there are situations, let's say you have children who have been engaging in a willful pattern of destructive behavior, and you've got a question as a parent of how am I going to deal with that? Well, if the child repents and is genuinely sorry and has learned his lesson, well, then it makes sense to be merciful. But on the other hand, if the child has not, it makes sense to let him experience the consequences of his action, the natural consequences. So as a result of grave human sin, we would ordinarily deserve grave consequences, in other words, going to hell. And God has made it possible for us to escape that. The specific means by which he did it was through Jesus' death on the cross, but in terms of practical application, what he asks of us is repentance that would make it appropriate for us to escape the natural consequences of our destructive choices. And so, so that's the answer of where justice applies on the day of judgment. There are, at least given what we read in Scripture, there are apparently people who do not repent and embrace God and cling to their destructive courses of patterns of choice throughout their lives. And it makes sense, given that, for God to allow them to experience the consequences of those choices, given the fact they haven't repudiated those choices and they haven't repented of them. And so that's where this role would come from on Judgment Day.
Perfect.
All right. Great, Daniel.
That makes sense to me, and especially now in, during the Advent season, I've been trying to get to confession. I've been going almost once a week, so it kind of ties together. So thank you, guys. Have a Merry Christmas.
You too. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks very much. Open forum. We continue. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Antonio listening on KSHJ in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Antonio.
Hello, sir, guys.
Hello.
Actually, I'm looking at your YouTube. Hello.
Oh, you're watching us on YouTube?
Yes.
I'm waving to you right now.
There may be a delay on YouTube, but you'll see him wave soon.
Yes, sir. I would like to apologize on my question. It's a little bit sensitive, but it's about aborted babies.
Uh-huh.
Me and my wife had a discussion that if you know, whether you know it or not, if a vaccine came from aborted babies, is that morally right, or actually, the straight question that I got is that if you know that the vaccine came from aborted babies, we should commend that aborted baby because that baby saved a lot of lives.
Okay, so there is not, in principle, anything wrong with developing a cell line from a donor. And this applies to whether the donor is alive or dead, if there's a way to harvest cells from a living donor. And just like we might give a blood donation, you know, to help save lives and so forth. And then that blood is then used. Let's say they found a way to duplicate blood, which actually they're working on. So maybe you could give some blood and then they could duplicate it and it could save a whole bunch of lives. Well, that's essentially creating a blood cell line. And there's nothing wrong with that. It would be wrong to kill the person and take their blood without their consent. Well, okay, that's essentially what's happened in the case of aborted babies. It is wrong to kill them, that's the abortion part, and then take their blood without their consent. Now, you can, got a frog in my throat. You can discuss, well, okay, once the baby is dead, could the parents give consent? Just like if you know frequently when a family member dies, there will be a question, do you, as the family speaking for on behalf of the person, if they have not made their wishes clear, do you think they would want to donate their organs? Or things like that, because sometimes people have not made that clear before they die, and the hospital needs to know, what do we do? And so they'll frequently turn to the family. Now, I find it somewhat morally problematic to say, oh, well, the person who voluntarily took the life of the baby then gets to speak on behalf of the baby.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's something's not right about that situation. But Once the cell line exists, it is not intrinsically wrong to use it regardless of what its source was. And now there can be, I'm trying to avoid big words, the word is extrinsic, but there can be other reasons why it is wrong to use it. Like it sets a bad example, it will encourage the death of more babies, things like that. But it's not in principle wrong to use a cell line to help people out once it exists, because you're not killing new babies and you're not robbing from new babies. Any moral crimes that were committed of that nature were committed at the beginning of the cell line. Having said that, as a result of that, the Catholic Church has recognized for a long time, not just during the COVID era, but actually going back decades, that it can be legitimate to use cell lines, even though it's not preferred to use cell lines that ultimately came from aborted children, in helping to save lives, that can be morally permitted. It's not the preferred method, and the choice, the church points medical researchers in other better directions, but it's not immoral to do that. So as a result, during 2020, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith released a document in which they said it was permissible from a moral point of view for Catholics to take vaccines for COVID that were otherwise safe and effective, and that there were better ways to approach developing such vaccines, but that it was not intrinsically wrong to take these vaccines, and taking them can be justified by various factors in a particular situation. Now, if I understood the question that was put to you correctly, Antonio, that should sketch the general principles that apply here. Yes, there is a beneficial thing that came out of the death of a particular baby in this case, and that's true of every evil that happens in the world. God would not permit any evil to occur if he wasn't going to bring some good out of it. So you can point at any evil you want and say, oh, well, there's good that's going to come out of that. Well, that's true, there is. But that doesn't mean the evil was justified. And so even though there is good that has come from the deaths of of some people, in babies in this case, that doesn't mean it was right to kill them. And so I wouldn't say you can justify, and I don't know this from the question the way you posed it, but if someone were trying to justify the killing of babies in this regard, or excusing the gravity of, oh, well, but good will come out of it, well, then that would be wrong, because good will come out of every evil in God's time. But that doesn't mean it's right to commit the evil.
I'm going to leave it there, Antonio. I hope that that was helpful to you. I'd like to get at least another caller on with Jimmy before we have to go for the hour. Next hour, don't worry, Father Paul Jerome Keller will be here. But thank you, Antonio. I appreciate the call. I'm going to go to the Poconos up in Pennsylvania. Vicky, listening on the Google Home. You there with us, Vicky?
It is.
All right. You got to be a little bit quick because we're coming up on it. Can you do that?
Okay. I can. I'm a cradle Catholic, and lately I've been enjoying kind of like a reawakening, praying the rosary and the devotion of Our Lady and stuff. And I have many
Beautiful.
Christian non-Catholic friends who seem to feel like this is pagan or something. They parrot the Bible and say, well, if it isn't in the Bible, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So how do I address them?
Well, it sounds like your friends are likely Protestant Christians, and as a result of that, they will typically hold to one form or another of a principle known as sola scriptura, which is Latin for by Scripture alone. And you'll hear different definitions of sola scriptura, but it'll very commonly be applied in such a way that if something is not mentioned in the Bible, then it should be rejected, or it's automatically suspect, or something like that. Well, we actually have a lot of literature at Catholic.com that deals both with the rosary specifically, because it is based on biblical principles, even though the practice is not itself in Scripture. It is based on principles that are biblical. And also we have a lot of information about sola scriptura. And so I would say I would study up on those resources, and I'm kind of keeping it brief since we're coming up on the end of the hour.
Yeah.
But I would say go to Catholic.com, type in rosary, type in sola scriptura, and there'll be a whole bunch of resources there for you. And those will give you the information you need to be able to engage in dialogue with your friends. If they're making specific charges of paganism, you can also look up paganism at Catholic.com. It'll have lots of helpful stuff for you. One thing, since we're approaching Christmas and we're giving out Christmas presents, why don't we send Vicky a copy of A Daily Defense?
Okay, sure.
Because it will not only contain information about sola scriptura and prayers to Mary and things like that, it will also contain dozens and really hundreds of other challenges that people might pose to the Catholic faith or to the Christian faith in general. And it'll prepare you if you, just to take it at your own speed. It's a challenge a day. It takes like three or four minutes to read. But it'll be a resource for you that you can use both to talk with your friends who've challenged you on this subject, as well as other people who may challenge you on other things.
Okay, Vicky.
Nice. Thank you so much.
Yeah, how beautiful that you're all this. You said you're a cradle Catholic, but kind of awakening up again to the practice of the Catholic
yes.
faith.
Yes, and I'm definitely enjoying the rosary and stuff. And it's just weird. Like whenever I say it, they give me that look, like It's not in the Bible. Like, okay, thank you.
Wow, they have very high pitched voices, your friends there in the Poconos. Maybe you're at a very high altitude. Vicky, hang on. We're going to send you, what are we spending? Oh, Daily Defense.
A Daily Defense.
365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. Jimmy Akin, I think we will not see you here again before
Until
Christmas.
Until tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow you're back?
Yeah.
Thursday. We see you Thursday?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Oh, of course. Okay, good. We'll see you Thursday then. All right. Well, I don't have to wish you Merry Christmas just yet, although in my heart.
Happy Advent.
Oh, yeah. Happy Advent, Jimmy. Father Paul Jerome Keller coming up. You can ask him anything you want, and there are exactly, there'll be at least one line open. I know that. Another hour of open forum, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not. Your call is welcome here. 888-318-7884. Let me just say it one more time. The Catholic Answers School of Apologetics courses all on sale right now. What are you waiting for? Shop.catholic.com. Right back after this.